This is Monday, the 21st of September, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Coming your way, the European Union meets Tuesday in an effort to agree on something to smooth the flow of immigrants.
The time for blame games is over. It's time for taking decisions, turning decisions into actions, and doing it united.
We'll talk with an expert on migration who says acceptance by Europe will turn out to be a positive experience. And you'll hear the latest attempt, or you hear the latest happenings in Burkina Faso. That's all ahead. There are new developments in the continuing story of migrants and refugees flooding into Europe. Hungary's parliament has authorized the government to deploy the army to help handle a migrant crisis, granting the military the right to deploy a range of non-lethal force. It passed a law saying the army could use rubber bullets, pyrotechnical devices, tear gas grenades, or net guns, that according to the text posted on the parliamentary website. Hundreds of migrants are waiting in northwestern Turkey, blocked by authorities from moving into European Union members, Greece and Bulgaria. About 150 migrants are waiting in a park in a city there. Nearly 1,000 others are camped out 8 kilometers from the border with Greece. Wessam Mohammed al-Abu, a 30-year-old Syrian migrant from Aleppo, says the migrants are waiting for the results of the EU summit due to take place Wednesday in Brussels, which he hoped would allow him to cross over. He says, "We hope they will open the border." Now, meanwhile, European Union foreign policy chief Federica Mogherini is urging the bloc to stop squabbling over proposals to share 120,000 refugees and find agreement at Tuesday's meeting of justice and interior ministers.
The time for blame games is over. It's time for taking decisions, turning decisions into actions, and doing it united as Europeans. Only in this way we will have the possibilities to face this issue, this urgency, this dramatic event, keeping faith to our European values, that are the values of respect of human rights, solidarity.
Mogherini was speaking with reporters in the Lithuanian capital of Vilnius. Tuesday, the EU ministers in Brussels are expected to decide on a European Commission proposal for the emergency relocation of 120,000 asylum seekers now in Greece, Italy, or Hungary. That number is in addition to the relocation of some 40,000 people from Italy and Greece, a move adopted last week. We welcome to International Edition Dr. Gilbert Burnham. He is co-director of the Center for Refugee and Disaster Response at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. Dr. Burnham, thanks for joining us here on International Edition. It seems as though this flood of migrants and refugees has increased greatly over the past few months, at least. Is that the case, or is it just a case of more international reporting on their trek?
Oh, no, definitely the numbers have increased, and this is very much a mixed group of migrants, so there are many different groups and different nationalities kind of rolled into this mass of humanity that's moving now.
Well, how many people are refugees? How many of these are migrants? And should we be making that distinction? And what is the distinction?
Well, the definition of a refugee is very clearly set out in the 1951 Refugee Convention, and that's somebody who has fled his or her homeland because of a well-founded fear of persecution. And certainly there are large numbers of Syrians that fit in that category. And I think that one of the reasons we've seen an increase in the number of Syrian migrants is that the viciousness of this war in Syria has just now continued to increase to a point where it just cannot be tolerated by people staying in the country. And I think that in many ways the alternatives in Syria, outside of Syria, in Lebanon and in Jordan and Iraq and Turkey, those are about saturated now. So I think we've saturated the sponge, as it were, who could absorb these. The viciousness of things have gotten worse. We see this massive flow. But at the same time, we have a flow of economic migrants, people from sub-Saharan Africa are hoping for a better life. We have a flow of people from Eritrea, where the political situation has deteriorated. We have the steady flow of people from Afghanistan, some of whom are legitimate refugees and some of whom are economic migrants. So this is a very mixed picture, and this is going to be a major responsibility of the Europeans to sort this out. Germany has a very well-developed system. They'll be able to handle this, I think, once that they get over the immediate surge of numbers. They can sort this out.
But other nations are having their difficulty. You have heard what that Hungary is literally and figuratively putting up their borders against these refugees and migrants. Everyone can't go to Germany, can they?
No, and definitely not. And I think we're even seeing Germans now saying, you know, in spite of our hospitality, we've reached about what we can handle. Now, if we look at the overall demographic picture of Europe and the size of Europe, it can certainly handle this number of people. That's not a problem. And at the same time, demographically, we see the workforce in Europe shrinking fairly dramatically. So many of us have been saying for some time that Europe needs to be thinking about some form of immigration policy that will bolster their workforce. And in some sense, the Syrians are a good fit for that. These are middle-class people from Aleppo and other areas, generally quite well-educated. They're a young group. They have a long working career ahead. So this could be a benefit, and I think that's probably one of the calculations that the Germans made.
You sound to be an optimist, sir.
Well, it's hard to deal with the problems of refugees, the problems of conflict, and not be an optimist. So I think that I'm also optimistic that we'll see the U.S. Taking maybe not its share, but taking a substantial number of Syrians as well from this disaster. And we also need to back up and say all of these population movements, such as we're seeing in Syria now, come about because of political failures in one way or the other. And how they're managed also deals with politics. And these are messy things, as we're seeing now in Europe right now. And they're messy things in this country where we're having issues about discussion of immigration. But these things will eventually be solved. And I have the faith that both Europe and the U.S. have the institutions and the capacities to resolve these issues.
Dr. Gilbert Burnham is the co-director of the Center for Refugee and Disaster Response at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, Maryland. Thank you, Doctor. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says the United States will resettle at least 85,000 refugees in the coming fiscal year, beginning October 1st, including a minimum of 10,000 Syrians and 100,000 refugees in 2017. Joining us is International Edition's Victor Beatty. Vic, tell us more about this.
Well, Ira, speaking in Berlin on Sunday, Mr. Kerry said the Obama administration would like to do more.
One of the reasons it's difficult is that post 9/11, we have new laws and new requirements with respect to security, background checks, and vetting. So it takes longer than one would like, and we cannot cut corners with respect to those security requirements. But this step that I am announcing today, I believe, is in keeping with the best tradition of America as a land of second chances and a beacon of hope. And it will be accompanied by additional financial contributions to the humanitarian effort, not only from our government, but from the American people. And that will become more specific in the next days.
Last week, more than 20 former senior U.S. officials, some of them who served in the Obama administration, urged the White House to accept 100,000 Syrian refugees in fiscal 2016, citing past U.S. efforts that allowed tens of thousands of Cubans and Vietnamese into the country. But two influential Republican lawmakers, Senator Chuck Grassley, chairman of the Senate's Judiciary Committee, and Congressman Bob Goodloet, the House Judiciary Committee chairman, issued a joint statement Sunday warning that terrorist groups like the Islamic State have made it abundantly clear that they will use the refugee crisis to try to enter the U.S. I spoke with regional analyst and associate professor Jonathan Edelman of the University of Denver about this.
The estimate is 2% of them could be ISIS fighters, or maybe even as high as 5. So I think both sides have a point. I think clearly this is not a very large number compared to the 4 million Syrians who've already fled the country and another 7 million who've gone to other places within Syria. But on the other hand, it would seem to me that our intelligence ought to be fairly good enough so that we would be able to, you know, at least spot a significant number of them. So I think when you balance it out, it's a concern. I think it is up to the intelligence agencies. But on the whole, there are profiles that, you know, should, you know, select out those people that we might be concerned about.
Russia's military backing, according to Mr. Kerry at his comments on Sunday, for the Syrian regime risks sending even more extremists to the war-torn country and could further hamper any effort to bring peace. Does he have a point?
Oh, there's no question about it. But the problem is, whose responsibility is this? In other words, we had an opportunity 3 years ago to really back up and arm and train the pro-Western secular moderates, and we skipped over that. And the result is that things have degenerated. I mean, if you just look at the numbers I was just quoting, over 50% of Syrians have either been killed, 250,000, left the country, 4 more million or 7 million, who are already upended from where they spent their entire lives.
International Edition's Victor Beatty with the story of what is happening in Syria. And we continue in that vein. Syria's role in Europe's migrant and refugee influx is dominating the discussion on social media today, as well as throughout the rest of the world. Michael Lippman is back from his extended holiday, joining me in the studio for more on that. Michael, welcome back.
Thanks, Ira.
Which social media platforms have you been looking at?
Well, one of them is Twitter, where I've seen two hashtags stand out as getting a lot of attention. Hashtag Syria Crisis has been used 65,000 times in the last day, according to the Topsy Analytics website. And even more popular is hashtag Syrian Refugees, which has been mentioned 83,000 times in the same period. By comparison, two other hashtags that had been widely used earlier this month are now less commonly mentioned on Twitter. Topsy shows that hashtag migrant crisis has been used only 2,000 times in the last day, while hashtag refugee crisis has had 4,000 uses. So that suggests to me that people really are starting to focus on how Syria has been fueling the wave of migrants streaming into Europe more so than other countries like Iraq or Afghanistan.
Well, you know, what we like to do, and whether it's good or not is open to contention, is to take a personal story and try to highlight it and throw a focus on it. So yes. I understand there's one refugee boy from Syria who's been the spotlight on social media. Tell us more about him.
Yeah, I can do that. His name is Zeid Almozin, and he is a 7-year-old who drew international sympathy earlier this month. That's when he and his father were filmed running away from a holding camp in Hungary and being deliberately tripped up by a Hungarian camerawoman who subsequently was fired by her Hungarian TV station. So what happened this past Saturday is that Zeid, who is a big fan of the Real Madrid soccer team, got to meet his idol, Real Madrid player and superstar footballer Cristiano Ronaldo. Zeid held Ronaldo's hand as Real Madrid walked out onto the field for a home match against Granada, and the 7-year-old had a huge smile on his face. Not surprising. You can see photos of that on Instagram, the other platform I looked at today. Just do a search for this Syria hashtag, and it's one of the top posts by an Instagram user named Rengosport. That user posted a picture of Zeid on the soccer field alongside an earlier photo of how he looked after being tripped up. And the contrast is pretty dramatic. So for more on that, you can follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE. You can also find me at @Michael_Lippin. Ira?
And Michael's still trying to cover that story so he can meet him as well. So.
Yeah. Oh, I would love to.
Thanks so much. That's Michael Lippin with us. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
While it may not taste as good as other sports drinks, British researchers say that they have found that drinking beet juice, supplemented with nitrates, helps athletes get through long sporting events by improving their running performance and boosting their decision-making abilities. The researchers from Exeter University recruited 16 male rugby, hockey, or football players as their test subjects. The athletes were all given about 140 milliliters, a little over a half a glass, of a high nitrate beet juice to drink every day for a week. At the end of the week, sportsmen were given physical and cognitive tests. The Exeter researchers said they saw an improvement in the athletes' running and decision-making abilities after drinking the nitrate-enhanced beet juice. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition. A new round of direct talks between the Yemeni warring sides would take place in Oman prior to the Muslim holiday of Eid al-Adha on September 24th. The Yemeni government is demanding guarantees from the United Nations that the Houthis will abide by Security Council Resolution 2216 before it starts negotiations with the militia's representatives and the ousted president, Ali Abdullah Saleh. Experts say such a meeting would add to the search for a negotiated settlement only if the Saudi-led coalition takes it seriously. International Edition senior Middle East reporter Mohammed El-Shenawi discussed the requirements for a successful outcome with a former U.S. ambassador to Yemen, Stephen Sesh. Mohammed, so far Yemeni President Hadi and the Saudi-led coalition say they won't accept anything short of the Houthis laying down their weapons and withdrawing from all areas they've seized since last year. How would that all work out?
While that's basically what the UN resolution is calling for, Ambassador Sesh believes that no negotiations will produce a settlement unless the sides are willing to give some sort of concessions.
Well, I think what President Hadi and the coalition perhaps are looking for is a commitment on the part of the Houthis to comply with the UN Security Council resolution. I don't think that they could expect, as you suggest, that the Houthis are immediately going to disarm and immediately withdraw from all the territory they've occupied. That doesn't strike me as a reasonable expectation going into a negotiation. But a commitment on the part of the Houthis to do so would be a very important step forward, and I think that's more along the lines of what the coalition and President Hadi are seeking.
However, the U.S. former diplomat warned against insisting on a total surrender of the Houthis, relying on the latest ability of the coalition to push them around. He noted that with the Houthis' control over the capital Sana'a, it's only wise not to rely only on the military means.
Mohammed, the UN already sponsored an initial round of talks in Oman between the warring parties to discuss some trust-building measures. What could be the next round later this month, and what could it add to the search for a negotiated settlement?
So far, Ira, the warring sides only exchanged fire in the battlefield. Now, the UN and the US are encouraging them to move to negotiations based on exchanging concessions, start reconciliation and reconstruction. On that, Ambassador Sesh said, no party should come to the table insisting on a maximalist position.
I think that all the parties now, and this includes the Houthis as well as the coalition, have to begin to see their way clear to make real, genuine, and serious concessions to the other, and not to set the bar so high that it becomes impossible for the other parties to accept those conditions.
Finally, Mohammed, even if the UN-sponsored talks in Oman did manage to produce a settlement, Yemen would still face some daunting challenges, wouldn't they?
You are absolutely right, Ira. Yemen is the poorest Arab country with very limited resources, and the Gulf countries, which joined the Saudi-led coalition, would have a moral obligation to contribute to the reconstruction of Yemen. However, Ambassador Sesh feels reaching a settlement sooner is a must to the security of the entire region.
Well, the first challenge, of course, is to end this conflict, enter the phase of reconstruction, reconciliation, and rebuilding a nation, if that's possible. And I'm not even sure what's going to emerge when this conflict ends. But the longer the conflict goes on, the less likely, it seems to me, is the prospect of a unified, secure, and stable Yemen emerging. And Saudi Arabia should be very worried about this. They can go in and they can continue to pound Yemen back into the 15th century through the air campaign, but it's not going to lead to a very stable, secure neighbor on their southern border.
Mohammed, thank you so much again for your insight.
Thank you, Ira, for having me.
This is VOA.
Next on Straight Talk Africa, President Obama welcomes Pope Francis to Washington, D.C. His Holiness' visit to the U.S. comes ahead of his trip to Africa in November. We'll discuss the significance of the Pope's travel next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC on Straight Talk Africa. That's next time on VOA Africa.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This is International Edition. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. There is a developing story in Africa. Burkina Faso's army says its troops are moving toward the capital, Ouagadougou, with the intention of disarming the presidential guard that seized power in a coup there last week. A military spokesman, Captain Hervé Ye, tells VOA's French to Africa service that the army has already issued a communique asking the presidential guard to surrender and move to an army base near Nation Square, a public gathering place in the capital. He said the army is waiting for a response from the guard, known as the RSP. Now, that group overthrew the transitional civilian government last week. Protests against the coup turned violent. It killed at least 10 people, injured more than 100 of them. West African negotiators announced a plan Sunday to restore civilian authority and offer amnesty to the coup leaders. Now, under this plan, elections set for October 11th, will be held sometime before November 22nd. We have reporters on the scene in Ouagadougou, and we will be bringing you throughout the day, throughout the evening, into tomorrow, what is happening there. Pope Francis leaves Cuba's capital and heads to the eastern part of the island nation Monday. He's there now, as a matter of fact, one day after meeting with the Castro brothers, who have ruled Cuba since 1959. The pontiff traveled to Holguín, which is the home of province of Fidel and Raúl Castro. The city of Holguín, more than 800 kilometers east of Havana, is known for a cross that has overlooked the town for centuries. Thanks for being with us, and head to voanews.com. I'm Ira Melman.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Economic disparity, often in combination with other factors, can open the door to violent extremism. Across many parts of the Middle East and North Africa, economic policies have led to the creation of parallel but deeply polarized economies, said U.S. Undersecretary of State for Economic Growth, Energy, and the Environment, Catherine Novelli. One is formal and often extends the full range of society's benefits to a relatively small and privileged group, but exacerbates perceptions of unfairness. The other economy is informal, marked by insecurity and characterized by low pay and little hope for a better future. According to the World Bank, the typical country in the Middle East and North Africa produces about 27% of its GDP in the informal economy and employs 67% of its labor force informally. In many countries, it is almost impossible for an individual to move from the informal sector to the formal sector, said Undersecretary Novelli. Women, she said, participate in the Middle East's workforce at the world's lowest rate. Many women, when they can't find jobs in the formal sector, become discouraged over time and end up dropping out of the labor force. ISIL has exploited these frustrations in its recruitment efforts by promising women valued positions in their state, and hundreds of women have fallen prey to this narrative. It is important to note that ISIL wants to cast blame on capitalism, or modernity, for creating many of these inequities. In the Middle East and North Africa, ISIL presents a false choice between the unjust status quo and a romanticized version of a 7th-century economy. The most effective way to confront these challenges is for countries to pursue sound market economy principles, embrace transparency and the rule of law, and ensure that all people have the opportunity to succeed. Embracing such reforms can go a long way toward blunting the message of violent extremists.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.